You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, if you're going to troll on in, you got to troll on in. You have a bunch of pictures of things that are okay to take and things that are not okay to take. You know, the planet loses species literally every day. And in the Pacific, and even in Hawaii, we are way up that food chain on loss of stuff. And I'm not sure why. We're going to answer some of those questions. But I can tell you that it is really, really great that we've been able to take, unlike, you know, the buffalo that used to roam and all of that stuff, we've learned the hard way in this in the country and in the world about protection of species and why they're all important. And once again, I told you earlier in the program, and last week, if you were with us, Asuka Ishizaki, who is the protected species coordinator at the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. And by the way, that nomenclature runs around her business card twice. It's a two-lapper. That's a long title. How are you doing again?
Good, thanks.
Nice to see you. Two weeks in a row. That's a record, right?
I think it is.
You know, am I right? I was reading somewhere the other day, and this is all things, insects, flowers, birds, fruits, and all that thing. For some reason, the tropics, and for some reason, Hawaii, we're losing more stuff than we're getting. How do you get a new species? It's pretty hard, isn't it?
It can
unless
be.
Unless it's invasive.
And that's an interesting question in and of itself. Where is the invasive line? But that's a whole other, I think, discussion. I think with Hawaii, oceanic island in the middle of the ocean, being so far away, everything evolves so uniquely here. And with not a whole lot of predators, not a whole lot of competition. And that makes you pretty vulnerable to, things coming in and creating new threats.
I do know that, and by the way, you can learn about a lot more about what we do by going to wpcouncil.org. There's a wonderful collaboration. The council is a quasi-governmental group that is comprised of all kinds of areas. NOAA, it's under auspices of NOAA. DLNR is in there, DOBOR, DOCARE. Everybody is a stakeholder. And what I think is interesting is everybody knows, driving around the island, when you see what they call an invasive species, they'll see these vines have like taken over whole areas of forest. Think, what is that? And we all remember the huge effort that the fishing community did at Lake Wilson during the Salvinia molesta invasion, which just literally took the whole place. How does one get involved in that? I want to go back in your life to when you made the decision, I think I want to deal with protected and endangered species.
Oh, that's a.
I mean, you must love the planet, and love the animals, love all the things.
I really started with turtles when it comes down to how I got into working with the protected species.
And by the way, that's when Asuka and I met years ago, and she was my turtle lady. Dr. George Balzis and Asuka became turtle folks, and so it morphed from there into other things, obviously.
Yeah, and I've always, was interested in wildlife. I went to a school for environmental science.
Where was that?
I went to a small school called Allegheny College in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, way back.
And then I did from there. You know, I was one of those kids who always loved wildlife. Thought I didn't really want to work with people. And then had this almost
I know a couple forest rangers like that. They want to climb up that tree and stay there for the whole winter.
Exactly. I was one of those kids. But then I had this great opportunity in college to go to a summer program in Kenya. Mm-hmm. And the whole program was about wildlife management. And we got to stay in this field site that was surrounded by these communities that raise cattle for a living. And they, herd their cattle across grasslands where there are lions roaming around.
Lots of predators.
And giraffes roaming around, and they have to live with them. Mm-hmm. And one of those communities, and we went and did interviews with them, and they said, we just want some help to keep our cattle safe at night from the lions.
let me tell you how basic that is. When we talk about really baseline, there's great stuff going on in schools right now here in Hawaii, and in the restaurants, from the farm to the table. And when we talk about that part of the world, it is from the tundra to the gully. I mean, these are not pets that they're herding around. This is a food source. And so if you got a bunch of tigers or lions or whatever coming in, you got a problem.
Yeah, and their entire culture is tied to the cattle, too. A really interesting culture. And, you know, for them, the cattle is everything, but then they also have to deal with lions. And so that really opened up my eyes to the whole people side of resource management and the importance of working with people, and that you have to get people's buy-in and look out for people's needs before you can protect the animals and the critters that you're trying to
protect. Yeah, that's really a good point. And I want to tell you, and I have a little firsthand experience in this, and that is that, you know, the song Turn, Turn, Turn to Everything There Is a Season reminds you that a lot of these species are way above our pay grade to understand how they play into each other, but they all do. And that you specialize in that. Let's talk about that a little bit, because if something is going to be listed as endangered, it might be providing a real service to the area in which it lives. And if you have that mosquito-eating guy gone, then there's going to be more mosquitoes than the area can handle. So it all works. There's some big picture somewhere.
Yeah, and that's the buzzword nowadays of ecosystem. Ecosystem-based fishery management is all about that idea that, you know, all these different components help each other out. And when you take something out, we don't know how that's going to affect it. Maybe it won't hurt it, but we don't really know. And, you know, there's the movement now is to protect all of those components and make sure everything is sustainable. And that's what we do in our fishery management at the council, too.
I got to tell you one thing that I've always been impressed by different members of the council at different times. Every now and again, you go back to the old Hawaiian rules and you find out that there was a rule that you couldn't catch this kind of fish for this many months. And you thought, wow, that chief was a serious guy that wanted to eat that fish. But they just knew. They just knew that that's when they breed or that's when they do. So don't take them if you do, there are consequences. And we've kind of lost that, you know, where a lot of people go fishing and if there's plenty of manini, they just catch them all. And they just say, wait a minute, these are babies. If you wait a year, they're going to be three times as big and feed twice as many people. Right? I mean, but it's not about, you're not talking about protecting or endangering food. You're talking about different species, right? So within the council job, what does that cover?
So for what we do at the council, it's primarily sea turtles, marine mammals, so cetaceans, dolphins and whales.
So we're looking at the monk seals, we're looking at birds.
And then we have seabirds. Those were kind of the typical protected species for a really long time. And then in the last 5-10 years, we've added a bunch more. Like we have a listed corals, not here in Hawaii, but in American Samoa and the Marianas where we work, there are now corals that are listed. And then recently, there's been a couple of shark species listed, and also the giant manta ray was listed this year.
You know, saw a picture the other day and I thought of you guys because it was this huge manta ray. I mean, I couldn't believe it was like 4,000 pounds. It was really, really big. And I thought, what does this thing eat? And why don't we eat it? Because it was a big piece of meat. They do eat them in some places.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
And raised, so therefore, they almost got fished out in some of these areas. Okay, so it's expanded a little bit. But by and large, you also should explain this. If you have a threatened species, like remember when we brought in the ta'api, for instance, didn't realize that it wasn't going to be a favorite edible fish right away by people, and it grew out of control and it ate a lot of other things, almost to the extinct point. You know, how do we repair something like that? Is it even possible to do it? You just have to say, well, we made that mistake. Let's not do it again.
I think there's been a concerted effort for, you know, some species. One of the good examples is the whole mice and birds here in Hawaii. Have mice that came in that humans brought in, and then they're eating native birds, and there's an effort to eradicate them, and it takes a lot of work to do that. And so I think in Hawaii, and this is not an area that I work in, but there's, you know, state of Hawaii does a lot in preventing invasive species from coming in the first place, because it's better to prevent it than once, you know, it's out of control.
You know, there's so many easy ways to see this. And those of you that travel should really know these things. I mean, even bed bugs and even other things that can be really horrific on an island, in an island atmosphere. If you go walking in the forest somewhere and you throw those shoes in a plastic bag and bring them home, when you get home, Astuka, that heebie-jeebies from that forest in Svengali or wherever you were could be a problem.
It can be, yeah.
Okay, let's get specific to some of the things that when you say your original concern was for turtle. Which kind of turtle? All of them or just a specific kind?
Worked on green sea turtles in Japan in a small island group called the Ogasawara Islands, where it's the largest green turtle rookery in Japan.
Okay.
And interestingly,
explain what that is. That's where these animals breed.
Yes, yeah, where they nest. Yeah. And so where the adults come to mate nest. Yeah, yeah. And the unique thing about Ogasawara is that they have had a limited harvest, a managed harvest of green turtles for the entirety of the time that people have lived there.
Yeah, and which is a long time, today. Right? Yeah.
Actually, it's only about a couple hundred years.
Oh, yeah, just a couple hundred years. But listen, that in your job, in your area, is a blink, right? I mean, sometimes I worry about what I'm going to have for lunch, and Asuka and her gang, they have to worry about what you're going to have for lunch in 2025, right? I mean, you need to have a way to project. If we keep going at this rate, this is what's going to happen to this species. Well, we can fix that by doing this or taking these steps. How do you assess that stuff? With the turtles, I mean.
Information is definitely key. Yeah. The with green turtles, as many of you probably know, the easiest way to count them is to count them at the nest. So they come back every several years. You count them every summer. You get a picture of how many nesting females there are.
Wait. Every several years. Are there some every year, but they only come back several years? Or is it several years and there's nobody there, then it's crowded? Or both?
You'll see turtles every summer, but a specific female will usually come back every few years. So they're staggering.
Okay.
So there's fluctuation because some years a lot of them come back and other years. You know, I think last year, a couple years ago, when they counted the green turtles in French Frigate Shoals, they're saying, oh, there's only 80-something this year.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it was a big news. But really, that's part of the natural fluctuation.
Yeah.
That the year before was a great year for them. A lot of the females came back. It was a good, they probably got had good food condition, got healthy enough to come back and breed. And next year, everybody's, taking that year off and nobody's coming back.
Yeah.
And it's just the natural cycle of the green.
Or maybe her boyfriend took a job somewhere else, didn't come back. But the thing that needs to be explained a little bit is we're pretty predictable. I mean, humans, we know there's a 9-month gestation period. A woman can have a baby every 9 months or every 10 months. But what about in that area? What about turtles?
So turtles, they'll nest, like I said, so the females will come back every several years. And once they come back in the summertime, they will, with green turtles, come to nest about every 2 weeks or so. And then they'll nest 4 or 5 times throughout the summer.
Okay, so they're actually breeding and nesting in that place.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so that must mean if they've taken a few years off, they're then going to lay a lot of turtle eggs?
Yes. Yeah. And so usually with green turtles and most of the other turtle species, they'll lay about 100 eggs in a nest.
Mm-hmm.
And so times that by 4 or 5. So they're, laying 400 or 500 eggs in every season.
But let me caution you listening to Asuka. Doesn't mean to jump for joy because the mortality of these things is horrific. They need to lay all those eggs because how many of them go from that cute little thing that you had hold in your palm to 400 pounds? Not that many.
Not that many. Yeah, the prevailing statistic is 1 in every 1,000 hatchlings make it to adult.
Yeah. Ooh, boy. So no wonder they're threatened. Now, are they threatened, endangered? What is the green sea turtle today?
The green turtle here in Hawaii, they're threatened.
Mm-hmm.
They've been on the threatened list since the 70s, ever since they were listed.
Okay, so however, almost anybody will tell you anecdotally now that there's a lot more turtles than there were in the 70s today.
Absolutely.
Is that true?
It is definitely true.
Yeah, yeah.
In Hawaii, we have seen a remarkable recovery of these green turtles. And as many of you probably know, the Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs petitioned to have the Hawaii green turtles removed from the
delisted.
Endangered Species Act several years ago. And the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NOAA, went through a review and looked at all of the green turtles, broke them up into different populations where they could. And they did separate the Hawaii one out, but they didn't delist it.
It was pretty exciting, though, wasn't it? Because, I mean, it showed the process at work, and it still shows that there's light at the end of the tunnel for that. I don't think that I can tell you, and I used to be among this gang. I think when Asuka and I met years ago, I sort of admitted this. We used to leave Hawaii Kai and fish turtles on the north shore of Molokai and then take them to Maui to the restaurants on Front Street and sell them. And that's what people did. I mean, it was not illegal. It was legal. I mean, the restaurants, you would say, we're going to go dive Molokai. You want turtles? Yep, I'll take 3 or whatever. You didn't realize what a source or what you were doing. Thank goodness there weren't too many people doing that. But now there are none. So what about the other thing that comes up? This is the longest question in this interview, I promise. There were, for a while, the green sea turtle was exhibiting or presenting with a lot of warts looking like things and growths and everything else. And there are a lot of people who said that, well, we caused it. That suntan lotion, whatever. What is that stuff?
It's a tumor that's called fibro papilloma. It's caused by a virus that's similar to a herpes virus. But we really don't know what causes the tumors to grow. We know that the tumors are associated with the virus.
Are they life-threatening?
But we don't know that. What we do know that some of them can die from the tumors, but a lot of them have been documented to recover from them. And so they've seen the same turtle over and over again, and the turtles, eventually the tumors go away. So
that's encouraging, right?
They can get cured from it. We don't know how.
I do know that out of Moanalua Bay, where this Malama the Bay has been going on, that there are some turtles that people almost know by name. And I do know that you can talk about it scientifically, how it happened. But wasn't there a project at one point in time to letter these animals, to try and to see, okay. And some of you in the science area got so big, so good at what you're doing that you could recognize it, right?
Some people might be able to, but that's what the tagging is all about. Yeah. You can either put a marking on the shell, or more commonly, they put flipper tags. And so they'll put tags on the flippers, or they can also do pit tagging. And so inject a small IT or chip readable tag. Kind of like the microchip in your pet, right? Same thing. So they do that to track the animals and to study them. So we know from that, too, that the tumors really aren't, they look awful. It's kind of a sad thing to see, but the good news is that hasn't stopped the green turtles here from recovery.
It's really interesting. I had a little chat, some of you may remember, with Dr. Andy Rossiter at the Waikiki Aquarium not too long ago, and on that subject we came up where they actually had one that had this big tumor that all of a sudden the next day it was gone. It had just the top part that manifested just came off. There was the damage to the shell and everything, but it looked like it came off on its own natural self. What is there a poor man's way to explain, or a common man's way to explain what those tumors are? We think, is it cancer? Is it a melanoma? Is it what kind of a tumor is it?
I love playing stump the doctor. I think you stumped me. I think you need to bring somebody
We'll do that because I want people to think. And I go in and out of the Hawaikai area a lot. And there's this place called Turtles. And it's also where I swim in front of the Outrigger Canoe Club. There's some turtles out there that are longtime residents. They're pretty territorial. And they've been pretty lucky. Now, when I say territorial, that doesn't mean that they stay there. But it is common once a turtle finds a good place, like a monk seal, right? They're going to keep returning to that because they have a comfort zone there.
Yeah, the turtles when in the foraging areas do tend to stay in those areas. Yeah. So one of the things that, there's a lot of studies going on in Hawaii looking at those foraging areas and tracking those turtles over time. So we were starting to better understand more about what's in the water too, not just the ones the nesting areas.
Interestingly enough, I'm not sure you got involved in this, but obviously this week is an opportune time to talk about it because there was a vote being taken about suntan lotion. And, taking a look at places like Hanama Bay and all of these other things where they've been able to show where certain of these chemicals that are in these things are really damaging to the reefs. But then it must have been frustrating, because it was for me, that they say, okay, well, we're going to pull those off the shelves in 2 years. And I'm thinking, if they're a danger, why didn't pull them off the shelf today? Isn't it sometimes funny how slowly the wheels work? Once science discovers something, to make it happen or to make it alter a law or make something go on or come off a list might take a long time.
Yeah, it can. And with the green turtles, I haven't followed too much on the suntan lotion issue, but I'm not aware of any scientific studies that have shown, that suntan lotion is causing any threat to green turtles at this point.
So, what do they eat, basically? For those that don't eat, typically, what does a green sea turtle eat in Hawaii?
Green turtles are eating mostly the grasses and the algae. Yeah. So they're usually vegetarian. They can eat other things, but they prefer to eat algae.
Yeah, and whenever you see a lot of that, there's a turtle somewhere because they're pretty smart. And in many respects, would an algae bloom be more dangerous if there weren't things eating it? What else eats algae besides the turtles? I know some fish do.
Fish
too.
Fish do a lot of different things too. Sea urchins too are one of the main food competitors with green turtles.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
But a green turtle is not going to eat a sea urchin, right?
I don't think they do unless they're chopped up.
Yeah.
If you try to feed them, they might actually eat them.
Okay, so what got you flagged and going on this thing was the turtles. But then it branched out. And I don't know if people really understand how many different things the council is looking at with regards to being endangered, threatened, or invasive for that matter.
Yeah, like I said, we look at turtles and marine mammals, birds, now oceanic white tips, all these new listings coming on. There was a wave of these petitions that came in several years ago with mostly environmental organizations mm-hmm. petitioning the government to say, hey, look, there's a species that we're concerned about. You should go and review it and see if you need to list it on the endangered species list.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And many people say, well, we should put all sharks on these lists. I know that there's been videos and stuff of shark finning in some parts of the world. It's no longer at all acceptable in Hawaii. If you bring in a shark fin, it better be connected to the whole shark if you're going to do that, right? I mean, so how endangered were our sharks in the Pacific where the boats fish as for taking them for their fins?
So most of the sharks, the only sharks that are listed right now in Hawaii or in the Pacific is one is the scallop hammerhead shark, except for the Hawaii population is not listed. And so the ones that occur in American Samoa and the Marianas, those are listed.
By the way, they're consumed in that part of the Pacific, aren't they?
I don't think that they in American Samoa and the Marianas.
Okay, I was thinking Sinamai, I thought, and some other places that it's very valuable protein. I mean, people that are sharkers, and there's people on the mainland that fish mako sharks all the time.
Yeah, and in Hawaii, too, there's not a whole lot of a big shark market, and there wasn't a big market to begin with. When they do bring them on, they're like makos. Yeah. The other species that was recently listed this year in January is the oceanic white-tip shark.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one where, we don't catch a whole lot compared to things like blue sharks, which is a more commonly bycaught species in the longline fishery. It's much, much rarer compared to that. But in other places, they are targeted and have been target of shark finning too. And a lot of the scientific information out there, and there's a stock assessment that was done on oceanic white tips, show that the catch per unit effort is declining mm-hmm. all over the place, which means that the population is probably declining all over the place.
Yeah, and that's a loud sign. It's pretty interesting. Some of you know that we have the guys from Wicked Tuna on a lot, and sometimes they'll fight what they think is a bluefin for a long time, and it's a shark, or it's a rat. It's an undersized fish that they have to let go. I think that we no longer see the day when boats would pull in with shark fins hanging from all the wires, because that used to be something that was pretty acceptable. I mean, before it was decided this was not good. If you catch a shark, the dried fin has more value than the meat of the shark, so they're just finning them and then throwing the carcass in the water, which wasn't doing anybody any good, was it?
No, and the shark finning hasn't been practiced in Hawaii for over a decade now.
I was going to say it's longer than 10 years.
It's been a long time. Yeah, I think it was like 2002 or something mm-hmm. when regulations went in. And so since then, a lot of the sharks that they're catching, they're releasing, and, if they're alive, they're releasing and they have a chance of surviving. And that was done, outside of the endangered species. That's one of the things, that with the Endangered Species Act and a lot of these organizations asking for the government to protect them under, ESA and call them threatened and endangered. But there's other ways of protecting them. And that's one of the things that we always try to stress when we write comment letters to these things is, we have mechanisms to be able to rebuild stocks like sharks.
Sure.
We can do that under the council's plan. We can do that under international agreements and RFMOs. And, there's other mechanisms to do it. And a lot of times the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, can be a really inefficient tool to do it, especially when you have things like oceanic white tips and a species that mostly occur outside of the U.S.
Yeah, we see
and most
them, right?
of the
yeah,
impacts
yeah.
are outside. Mm-hmm. And the Endangered Species Act can only go so far. Mostly it has power in the United States.
Yeah, and you know what? That's where we are. And I can tell you another thing, and that's why it's always been interesting. Every time Asuka is here, Asuka Ishizaki is the Protected Species Coordinator for the council, the WPCouncil.org is where you can find some of her work. I guess maybe I mentioned earlier that there's people need to know the difference between endangered and protected. I know that almost everybody says endangered is protected, but what is that? Is that to the degree of impact to that species?
Yeah, so under the Endangered Species Act, there's the endangered, which is the more critical, closer to extinction level. Yep. Threatened is the lower level. So it's one or the other. Protected is more of a general term that we use, so it's not part of ESA or anything. So it's usually threatened or endangered. Technically, the way that Congress intended it was when you have an endangered species, you have more restrictions on them. Mm-hmm. You can't take them. You know, you need special authorization to take them. Whereas threatened, Congress intended so that there's no immediate take prohibition that goes into place, and that there would be rules specifically for that species to say, here are the threats, and so here are things that we need to prohibit and make that flexible. But unfortunately, in the implementation of the
very
ESA,
it hasn't really been that way.
Yeah. And Fish and Wildlife Service in particular has been applying automatic take prohibitions on both threatened species and endangered species. And now they're actually going through the process of rethinking that and working on a rule to not do that automatically and go in for every species.
Yeah, you must have sometimes a great affinity when you read stories that are not in your wheelhouse about other endangered or protected, whatever they are, and everybody hears about invasive species. We talked earlier, and we talked a little bit last week with Asuka about we are an island, and we have lost an awful lot of seabirds to things like rodents, right? And we've lost a lot of our fish, and some of the fish that we are losing, or some of the animals that we are losing, you can't find them somewhere else. It's hard to go. Is that because of our our isolation, our distance? What makes us so? How do we lose things?
Yeah,
just too many people? What's up?
Especially for land animals and not the marine animals that we have here, there's not a whole lot that are very unique. There's a unique species here because the ocean is connected ultimately. But for the land species, yes, they evolve very uniquely here. Like the birds are a very good example, right? They're forest birds. They adapted to specific flowers. They have they're dependent on certain flowers or plants. And when that plant goes away, they can, the habitat goes away, or there's a mosquito that comes in, brings in a disease that wasn't here before.
Yeah,
it's hard because they don't have the immunity against it. And so the uniqueness of Hawaii as an island certainly makes them more vulnerable to extinction.
Asuka, the thing I learned in way back in high school was when in the discovery, I'm not talking about the initial discovery by the original Hawaiians, but what I'm talking about when Captain Cook and others started coming around, a simple thing like the flu would kill people because their immune system weren't able to deal with that. Aren't some of our species the same way? If something invasive comes in that's never been here before, our animals or our birds may not have any mechanism to fight that off.
Yeah, that's exactly a similar situation, I think.
I do know that there was a big deal a while ago about dumping bilge water and all of that stuff. Foreign vessels that come into the harbor, they're trying to say, don't dump your bilges in. You have to be, 100 miles offshore or something like that before you can do that stuff? That's part of it, isn't it? Us not going down to the beach and catching a turtle is one thing, but when you have ships out there that are disgorging all kinds of who knows what's in those things?
Yeah, and just like we, work on fishery laws, there's, other laws that protect, against those kinds of pollutions, too. Yeah. And so they all work together in making sure that, our resources are healthy.
What's the light at the end of the tunnel when something is identified as endangered or threatened and then put in to be protected? That, all right, every now and again, we've done so well at this, it's okay to remove it from that. We don't need to worry. I don't see that happening as often as I see things going on the list, but that must be something that's very gratifying to people that do like you that do what you do.
And that's definitely been, criticism of the Endangered Species Act is that there hasn't been a whole lot that comes off. You know, you put a lot on, it stays there.
Yeah.
That's kind of the criticisms that you hear a lot. And it can be true. In Hawaii, there hasn't been a whole lot that's been delisted. Yeah. The most recent example we had was the humpback whale.
Yeah.
They do, you know, they are continuing to be protected under a different law called Marine Mammal Protection Act. But still, you know, the National Marine Fisheries Service recognized that the humpback whales have recovered to a point where they don't need that ESA.
And which is that is proof in the pudding. And I guess, you know, that's kind of a way to level things out. But I do know that there should be ways in people it can do this now when they see one of these species that's in trouble. I mean, it used to be, gee, I think that guy's catching a turtle. He's not supposed to be catching a turtle in that net, right? If we did catch too many turtles in the nets, they would go not only back onto the highly endangered list, but they'd disappear.
They can, but that's where the science comes in.
Yeah.
You need good monitoring. You need good information to monitor what the population is doing and what the threats are. And, you know, look at those numbers and see if it's actually impacting the population. And we have tools to do that.
Yeah.
We have, you know, the scientists to be able to do that. I think what the Endangered Species Act does do is it puts resources to be able to do those monitoring. I think one of the concerns that came up when, you know, the discussion about delisting Hawaii green turtles was if it does come off the list, then what? Who's there to continue to monitor them and manage them? You know, can the whole state of Hawaii do it? Do they have the capacity to do it? That was one of the big questions.
Yeah, and let me interject, and I think this is important. I was talking to this dear friend of mine, very old guy, Hawaiian guy, a fisherman all his life. Now he's a little too old to fish, but he's never too old to pass down some of his wisdom. And they said that, you know, a lot of times when something gets endangered and goes away, it's too late. And, you know, and we've had too many things that are too late. And you don't want to take a kid down to the beach and say, we used to come down to there were these things out there called fish. You know, so the light at the end of the tunnel for you must be when something either gets naturally comes back on its own. Case in point, let me just quick interjection. A lot of you that are out there probably read lately or saw the TV lately on the alala, the crow, which is another bird that was virtually extinct and pretty much is again. There's only a few of them left. That must be very, very difficult for those of you in science that want to say, we have to do something. We have to make a place where we can grow these things and introduce them back into the wild. Can we do that with our sea creatures? Can we raise them in captivity and help this thing out?
You know, a lot of people have tried that with green turtles. Mm-hmm. There are certain things that can be done, but how much it actually helps, we don't really know. Mm-hmm. With green turtles, one of the things that we still don't know is how they learn how to come back to where they nest.
Of course,
right?
Like salmon going and upstream,
so
right?
What we do know is that there's some magnetism associated with it, that they can detect the magnetic field.
Jeez.
What we don't know is when they imprint it and how they imprint it. And so if you've, you know, fiddle with that early stage of life, and if they're imprinting at that point in time, you might be affecting their ability to come back. We don't know, you know, those things. And so, and then the other difficulty with the green turtles is they take a while to mature. And so when you, and then a lot of times you don't see them once they leave the nest as a hatchling, you don't see them until they're adults. And so it might be 25 years
and
before
where
they
are they
coming
in the medium?
Back.
Where are they in the meantime?
And
we
don't know that, right? You know, we don't know. And so to be able to find out, okay, we did these, you know, hatchling programs, we protect them, re-raise them, re-release them. It takes another 20 years to be able to, and 30 years to be able to evaluate that.
Okay, so let's you and I get together in 20 years and discuss what happened from this date to 20 years, okay?
Sounds like a plan.
If people want to know more about endangered species, protected species, where can they go on the council's website?
thebpcouncil.org, and you can go to the protected species section of the website.
And I do that. I did that before we met, and there's a wealth of information there. Asuka Ishizaki, thank you for joining us. See you again pretty soon.
Thanks for having me.
Yep, and thanks to you for listening. And remember, if you want to hear something on this segment, you can get in touch with it. Go to wpcouncil.org and send them an email, or send one here to The Mike Buck Show, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Have a great day fishing. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you next time. Aloha.